Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is, actually, I should start over. Is your last name pronounced Genovese?
Yes, correct.
Okay, so I'll start over at 12:04. Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Piero Genovese. He gained a master's degree in 1989 and a PhD in 1993 in animal ecology at the University of Rome, carrying on research in carnivore ecology. Since 1996, he has worked with the INFS, the Italian Wildlife Institute, the Italian Government Research Institute for Conservation, focusing on carnivore conservation and alien species. He's coordinated several research projects and worked closely with the Italian Ministry of Environment and with several international institutions. In 2000, he was nominated chair of the European section of the IUCN SSC-ISSG, and in 2005 appointed deputy chair of the ISSG. In this capacity, he has coordinated many activities on invasive species, providing technical support to states and institutions on the field of invasive alien species and management, and for the development of policies on the issue. At present, he is senior conservation officer with the ISPRA, where he coordinates the activities of alien species management. So, first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much.
So, can we start by talking about what are invasive species and how big of a problem is this?
When we talk of alien invasive species, we talk of species introduced by man. So this is something that we cause, and we talk of any kind of organism that we introduce outside their natural range. So over the history of man, we have moved around the globe, and in many cases we have taken with us species, introducing them into the natural environment outside the natural range where these species have evolved. And when we talk of invasive species, we talk of these introduced species that cause harm to the environment. So we are talking of any kind of organism, from plants to animals, that are introduced artificially outside the range and that are harmful to the environment.
So this, it seems to me that that these invasive species are probably one of the worst problems facing wild species in wild places, maybe after direct habitat destruction. Because I think about the chestnut blight, I think about chytrid, and those are causing just those have caused and are causing just untold harm.
Now, indeed, this is a huge problem for biodiversity globally. It's something we started to realize how severe is the impact caused by invasive species only recently, a few decades ago. And, you know, in the IUCN community, in the we work a lot on with the red list data, so with data related to species at risk of extinction. And from the information we compiled from all over the world, we realized that invasive species are the first cause of extinction globally. So in terms of species that disappear, all the data that we have show that in the last, let's say, 400 years, species introduced by man have caused the larger amount of known extinctions. Just to give you an idea, about 40% of all known extinctions have been caused also by invasive alien species, and about 20%, from 15 to 20% of extinctions have been driven only by invasive alien species. So this is by far the first driver of species extinctions globally. But of course, biodiversity is not only about extinctions. We have many cases, as the ones you mentioned, where we have a loss of environments, we have a destruction of at a lower scale, And if we consider the general trends in biodiversity globally, we see that invasive species are probably the second most serious driver of loss of biodiversity after habitat loss and fragmentation. And what is more alarming to us is that this is something that happens in all environments. We have many cases of invasions, we call them biological invasions, in the sea, in freshwater, in mainland. And also what we see is that the trend of invasions is growing at a very alarming rate. So in all environments, in all taxonomic groups, the data we have show that there is a steep increase in the number of new invasions.
And I'm guessing that there is also a correlation or some sort of relationship between invasive species sort of piggybacking on other harms, such that if you have habitat that is fragmented, that, or if you have a healthy biome, it might be a bit more difficult for an invasive species to get a foothold than if the biome is healthy. Oh, I want to mention one example of this, and I don't know that this theory is actually shown to be true, but it's a theory I heard several years ago that made some sense to me, which is that one of the reasons that the chestnut blight was able to successfully kill off the chestnuts is that the passenger pigeons had been eradicated, and passenger pigeons were in these immense flocks that would poop so much they would make the soil very acidic. And so the less acidic soil ended up causing the chestnuts to be a bit less healthy than they would have been otherwise and less able to fight off the blight. And whether or not that's true, the short question I should have just asked is, so is there a relationship between also these invasives and the other problems that the wildlife faces?
Well, of course, there is a strong correlation between invasive species and other drivers of change. For example, what we have seen is that climate change and the warming globe can facilitate invasions, especially in some areas of the world. Of course, if you think of the Arctic Sea, just to give an example, where new routes of navigation have been opened because of the warming climate, that of course poses a huge risk to that environment, because many more species could arrive there and have an impact. And of course, very often invasive species enter via disturbed environments. One element that is important to stress, I think, is that the strongest correlation between the number of invasive species or the level of invasions is with the economy. This is a threat that is strongly linked with the globalization of the economies. So, of course, for example, we find more invasive species in countries that have higher levels of trade or of tourism, and we see more invasive species in urban areas compared to very wild areas, because urban areas or ports or airports can be entry points for invasive species. At the same time, I think it's what you said is partly true for some environments, especially, for example, in forests. A very untouched natural environment is less at risk of being invaded in some cases. But we also have to say that in many cases, even the most undisturbed areas are vulnerable to invasions. And one example is that all the information we have show that protected areas are particularly impacted by invasive species. Even in regions of the world like New Zealand or the Pacific, where the impact by humans have been less severe than, for example, in Europe or North America. And if we If we look at some environments like islands or freshwater, these environments are particularly vulnerable to invasive species. So even if you have a very natural freshwater, a spring in the mountains, but if you release some predator fish in that environment, you are going to destroy it in a very short time. I don't think we can only rely on protecting our environment. Invasive species can be very destructive, even in areas that are still moderately impacted by humans. And we need to protect these environments, particularly with a particular care, of course.
So I would like to come back to the trade question in a little while, but I have a couple more questions first. One of them is, could you give a couple, three examples of historical invasions for people who may not know? Like I mentioned the chestnut blight. Can you talk about some particularly devastating or typical or atypical, either way, of invasions that have happened prior to the present, like 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 70 years ago, 300 years ago, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I'll try to give you a few examples that show how species can be moved, sometimes intentionally and sometimes accidentally. So if you think, for example, of the Canadian beaver, that is very familiar for many North Americans, and it's a very important species for many environments. It's an ecological engineer. It's a very important component of the forest environments of the northern part of North America. The Canadian beaver has been introduced intentionally in the Tierra del Fuego, at the very top of the Argentinian country. So at the opposite of the continent, just after the Second World War, to try to start fur industry in that area. The effects have been just devastating. The beaver has been introduced in a forest that have evolved without this species, so all the trees are very vulnerable to the effect of the Canadian beaver. And huge areas have been totally devastated by the impact of the Canadian beaver, and the soil in that region is not rich enough to allow a regeneration of the forest. So at the moment, there is a very large area between Argentina and Chile that is impacted by the Canadian beaver, and there are attempts to try to preserve this region, this very important region from a biodiversity point of view, from the impact of this introduction. Another example is the arrival of the zebra mussel in the Great Lakes region. When it was found in the 80s, it took some time to understand how this mollusk had arrived to this area. And then we realized that probably it was moved in the ballast waters of the vessels that arrived from Europe. So probably not everybody knows that all the ships around the world have tanks, plenty of water that stabilize the navigation. In that water, they transport thousands of species from one region of the world to the other. So in general, when they to keep the navigation stable, ships have to fill these tanks with huge amounts of water. So in that case, the zebra mussel arrived in the Great Lakes area, and they started in a very short time, they became very abundant, and they have this characteristic of creating incrustations in, for example, in the pipes that were used to for industries, and they blocked navigation, they blocked industry, they created a huge cost, a huge economic cost, and they also displaced the native mollusks in that area. There are many examples, especially in recent times, so in the last 100 years, and that is because we have realized that the trends of invasion have exploded from the beginning of the 19th century, so about 150 years ago, due to the increase in the globalization of the economies, as I said, and so with the increased level of trade, of transport, and of tourism.
So I have been an activist and writer for 20, 25 years and worked on environmental issues for that long. And the issue of invasives is, even with all the work I've done on deforestation and other issues, the issue of invasives is one of the most, honestly, depressing for me, because it seems that so often, this is a lesson that we haven't really learned. And I'll give an example. Is the California Department of Fishing, I live in California in the United States, and the California Department of Fish and Game still intentionally stocks trout in lakes that shouldn't have any fish in them. And then they eat the frog eggs and cause the local frogs to go extinct, and also the native trout, golden trout, to go extinct or to be extirpated from regions. And it's just, so they're intentionally actually harming, or like you mentioned about the beavers. These are stories we've heard again and again. And I don't know what my question is. It's just, I guess I want to express admiration for you for working on such an important and heartbreaking issue.
No, thank you, Derek. But I think it's very important that people like you stress that we need to urgently work on this issue. And of course, when I describe the patterns of invasions and the huge impacts, there is a risk of just saying there is nothing we can do. That is not true. I think we are winning a lot of battles, and the situation can improve. If we look, for example, I mentioned the data that we have published on the patterns of invasions globally, and we still see an increase in all taxonomic groups and in all environments, but at the same time we start seeing some reduction in the rates of invasions, especially in groups that are moved intentionally, fish, as you mentioned, or the trout, or mammoths. So increasing the awareness of people can help reducing the rate of invasions. And another encouraging development is that many countries around the world, including the European Union, have been working with the European Parliament to develop legislation that has been adopted a couple of years ago, now regulate the movement of the most harmful species. There are countries such as New Zealand, Australia, and more recently Norway and Iceland, that have a very stringent border system to try not to let in any invasive species in their territories. And there is a higher attention also in the developing world. I often attend a political meeting to try to explain the need to work on this issue, and I see an increase in attention by, for example, African countries, because they see the huge impacts of invasive species, not only on their environment, but also on their livelihood. So I think that we can reduce the problem. We cannot stop it. I think it's impossible to think of totally stopping the movement of species, but we can prevent the most harmful invasions, and we can more effectively than in the past manage the invasive species that are most harmful at present. We have become much more effective than in the past, for example, in removing invasive species from islands, and that has saved hundreds of species and threatened populations. When we looked at the data on the conservation status of threatened species a few years ago, we realized that the removal of invasive species from islands had been the most effective conservation action globally. So that has been the kind of intervention that has helped many, the highest number of threatened species to recover. And we also see that in some cases, prevention has been particularly effective. I mentioned the case of the Great Lakes region. A few months ago, the world community adopted an international convention for the treatment of ballast waters. And now all the countries in the world are working at treating these waters so to reduce the risk of invasions. Just to give you a positive message, in the Great Lakes area, ships are now required to exchange the water they use for in their tanks far from the coast. And just changing the water they use has reduced the rate of invasions in the Great Lake area of about 95% to 99%. So I think it's possible to do much more, but the first element is that we need to raise the awareness in the public. We need to explain what we are talking about and why it is important to work jointly on this issue. Because after all, as I said at the beginning, this is very much linked to our action and to our behaviors. So the movement of invasive species is strongly linked to our behaviors. You know, it is humans that release droughts in the rivers. It is humans that move goods around the world. And without working together and adopting more responsible behaviors, this is not a battle that we can win.
So a question I should have asked you at the beginning or near the beginning is, how is it that so often invasives, just on sort of an ecological or biological level, how is it that so often that the invasives do so much harm? Why does that happen?
Well, first of all, I think it's
like the zebra mussels. How did they take over so much as opposed to what happens in their native land? Native water.
Okay, first of all, it's only one fraction of all the species that are moved around the world that are harmful. And there are many species that are many exotic species are very valuable for our lives. So if you think of the food that we eat or the plants that we have in our gardens, many species that are important to our livelihood are of non-native origin, but are not causing any harm. So if I think of tomatoes in Europe or potatoes or whatever, we have brought from Americas many species that are essential for our livelihood without creating any particular harm to the environment. So in general, what we say is that of the thousands of species that arrive, for example, via ballast water, only a few of them will establish into the natural environment, and only very few of them will create an ecological damage. How does this happen? There are many mechanisms. I mentioned islands, and you know, the easiest example to make is predators. So when we introduce rats or other predators into oceanic islands where native species have evolved without predators, so without evolving defensive behaviors. For example, there are many islands of the world where, think of Galapagos, many birds have lost the ability to fly because they didn't have predators. So in those cases, the arrival of an introduced predators can destroy one species in a few weeks or months. It's incredibly rapid. Then, in some cases, invasive species are particularly successful because in the environment where they arrive, they find conditions that are suitable, and they may find an environment where they don't have the limiting factors that they had in their natural range. So they may have an area without their predators or without parasites that limit their populations. So there is a combination of factors that explain the success of some invasive species. What we can say is that around the world there is a limited number of species that are successful everywhere. So I think we can identify now the species that are more at risk of becoming invasive elsewhere, and that can help us focusing our prevention efforts toward those species.
Could you give a couple of examples of successful invasives eradication programs?
Oh, well, yes, indeed. As I said, the most successful examples are the eradications of invasive species on islands. This is something that is not something we can do everywhere or on all organisms. In general, eradications can only be done on vertebrates, but the removal of rats from many islands of the world have increased enormously the reproductive rate of the, for example, of birds that were living on those islands. In general, we estimate that about over 300 species have benefited of the removal of rats and other predators. In Italy, for example, we are working at the removal of a North American squirrel that is threatening our native squirrel. We have only one species of squirrel in all Europe, but that is the red squirrel. And the arrival of the American gray squirrel is outcompeting our native species with the effects at the entire scale of our forest, because the native red squirrel was very important for example, the regeneration of the natural environment. And wherever we manage to remove the American gray squirrel, we see a coming back of the native species and or a consolidation of the native populations, and with wider effects in terms of environmental recovery. So the examples are very many. There are many species that, like many bird species, that have been recovered after eradication of introduced predators and on islands. For example, in Antigua, a very rare snake, the Antiguan racer, has been is coming back from the brink of extinction after an eradication of rats. Or if you think of, for example, in Langar Island in Canada, the population of the ancient morelets has doubled after the removal of rats from those islands. This is something sometimes really incredibly rapid, the positive effects after rat eradications. We have a very endangered species of shearwater, a marine bird in Europe, and in Italy, when we removed rats from the island of Monte Cristo, we saw the reproductive success of the shearwater in that island passing from zero when the rats were present to 80% of nests that successfully brought to fledging to new individuals in just 2 years. So the effects can be very surprising and very rapid.
So I want to come back to the Italian squirrels in a moment. I mean, to the U.S. introduced squirrels in Italy in a moment. But before we do that, when you talk about eradication on an island, How big is one of the largest islands at which they've been able to successfully get rid of rats? Is it like a square mile, or is it like 50 square miles, or how big can they do that actually is possible, feasible at this point?
Well, you know, I think that usually I think it's important to make a parallel with the sanitary effort. So we managed to remove smallpox from Earth, or we managed to remove the rinderpest virus from Earth. So we can do huge eradications depending of the effort that we can devote to these interventions. One of the most successful eradications has been the removal of rats from the South Georgia region in the subantarctic. This has been a huge project that has removed rats from over 60,000 hectares, so a huge region. Working with a team of helicopters and with many tons of rat baits, rats have been completely removed from the entire region. So it is possible to remove species also from very large areas, depending on the commitment and the resources that are involved. And another example is the removal of the ruddy duck from Europe. The ruddy duck was introduced intentionally for ornamental reasons in the past, and it hybridizes with the native white-headed duck, a very rare species of ducks endemic of Europe and the Palearctic. And removing the ruddy duck has required several years of work by many countries, including Spain, the UK, Belgium, the Netherlands. But now it's more or less completed. There are only a few individuals left in the wild. And once the eradications will be completed, I think this will secure the future for our endangered white-headed duck.
So what is your experience of the general sort of political will to of different countries to actually fund these efforts? Do you find that you have to fight very hard for that, or do you find that a lot of countries are very eager to do this?
No, it's very difficult to find enough support because of. Initially, you know, this was considered only an environmental problem, and many countries in the world don't necessarily put environment as their top priority. So, for example, when I talked at the European Parliament for, you know, defending the idea of introducing legislation, I explained that this is an area where protected environment can also help protecting our industries and our economies, because we show with solid data that if we manage to reduce the problem, if we manage to prevent the arrival of invasive species threatening our environment, exactly the same species were responsible for also harming our economy. And that was a very effective argument for convincing decision makers to work more on this issue. But in general, I think it is still an area where decision makers don't see as a priority and donors don't see as a priority. So we launched about 1 year ago during the World Conservation Congress that was held in the Hawaii, we launched what we call the Honolulu Challenge. So a global initiative to try to raise attention and to raise more funds to work on the problem of invasive species. But there is still a lot of work to do to convince countries, decision makers, and more in general, the entire society, that this is an important area of work for conservation.
You know, as I mentioned earlier, I've been an environmental activist for decades, and what you're saying is reflected in my experience of a lot of activist groups that I've worked with a lot of groups that are working on trying to remove dams. I've worked on with groups that are trying to stop fracking, that are trying to stop deforestation, et cetera, et cetera. But there have been fewer groups who are actively working to stop invasives or to remove local invasives. I see it some, especially with plants. I see it quite a lot. But I don't see the emphasis, and I'm merely validating what you just said, that I wish there was more emphasis on it.
No, I agree with you, and I understand that, you know, for NGOs that rely on their memberships and rely on the support of the society, this is an area of work that may be less rewarding, but it is definitely much less easy to explain to the public than other threats to conservation, including climate change or habitat loss or trafficking and so on. So, for example, in the work I have done in Italy with the American gray squirrel, it has been very difficult to explain to some NGOs, especially those working more on animal welfare, that it was important to deal with this threat to protect our species, because after all, we were talking of removing a nice furry animal from the environment, so it's not simple to explain it. And also in the case of the rabid duck eradication in the UK, the Royal Society of Protection of Birds had a very strong discussion within their membership to explain why it was important to start that project. So I think the level of attention in environmentalist world is also due to the fact that the actions that are required, regulating trade, regulating movement of species, in some cases removing species, are less appealing to the public and require some time to explain why this is important and why this is essential for the environment. At the same time, I think the level of awareness is increasing, and it's always important to take the time to explain things. Because, you know, in my work, I've been, for example, involved in reintroduction of wildlife. And initially, many years ago, we thought that this could be a solution to the loss of biodiversity. Then we realized that reintroducing species without solving the problems that had brought populations down to the level where they were was not a solution. And we had to explain that it was not the solution, but that it was much more important to work at the habitat scale. And that is, I think it's a message that has passed to the society. It took time, but it has arrived to all the public. So I think we need to be brave and courageous in explaining things, even if they're not very appealing, because this, after all, this can bring to raising an understanding on the environment and of the complicated relations that are behind biodiversity and the evolutionary trajectories that we want to preserve. And after all, it brings to a growing of the environmental understanding in the public.
So we have about 7 or 8 minutes left, and I have a wind-down question in a minute, but before we go there, you've talked a bit about rat eradication or ruddy duck eradication. What can be done about some of the microorganisms like chytrid or, let's go with chytrid or white nose fungus for bats. What can be done about something that is so small that you can't put out rat bait or anything like that? What do we do about chytrid?
Now, first of all, I think let's try to think of how we've done to treat diseases that have impacted humans or livestock all over the world. We know that, you know, curing is important, treating the viruses or the bacteria is important, but prevention is far more important. So this is one message that is particularly important to give. With the chytrid fungus, this is devastating amphibian populations all over the world. The main message is be careful, don't move frogs or other amphibians around the world. For example, scientists are now much more aware that they need to sterilize their equipment, they need to be very careful when they capture animals and they move them around, and the trade in amphibians should be very strictly regulated, because we have evidences that the amphibians trade have been one of the cause of expansion of the chytrid fungus around the world. So prevention is definitely the key message. The other point is that we have good examples of treatment or management options that have effectively addressed even microorganisms. If you think of the struggle against mosquitoes and the viruses or the diseases that they carry, like malaria, in my country, Italy, was strongly affected by malaria after the Second World War, and now we have totally eradicated the disease from Italy and from many other countries. So it is possible, it requires investments and commitments, but it's doable in many cases.
So what do you want people who hear this interview and who care about the land where they live, what do you want them to do both locally, and what message do you want them to take away that will change how they perceive the world? And then also, what do you want them to do globally? How can they support your work too? All three of those questions.
I think what is very important to reduce, to mitigate the impacts caused by biological invasions is, on the one hand, to value your native biodiversity. So, you know, sometimes people perceive the term biodiversity as just a combination of species. So people may think that the zoo is very rich in biodiversity. And of course, this is not true. So our native biodiversity, the species that live around our gardens, our house, are extremely important because they have co-evolved in the same area, and they have adapted to the very specific local context. So, for example, in our gardens or for our animals, we should value more the use of native species compared to sometimes more, you know, colorful, exotic species. And the other point is that as it has happened with the climate change, where a large part of the society has realized that it was important to support political actions to try to reduce the footprint of people and to reduce the use of, for example, industries that creates carbon dioxide. The same should happen with invasive species. We need to work jointly and ask our governments to be more active on this issue, being prepared to a little bit more of you know, regulations in what we can buy in order to encourage the development of more effective policies, as in the case of the Ballast Water Convention that I mentioned before, and that has been a great achievement globally. Nothing can be achieved unless there is a support coming from the bottom, from the society, toward decision makers.
So is there anything else about invasives that you've wanted to say that I haven't given you the chance?
Well, I think that it is essential to remember that not all exotics are bad. Many of them are useful and nice and good to eat. So we are focusing only on a fraction of the species. And I think the message is that it is a very serious threat, but in general, we're only working on a tiny number of species, and that altogether we could identify those species, and we could work also at the community level to carry on struggles, very focused on the priority battles to be done.
Well, thank you so much for your work and for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Piero Genovesi. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio and the Progressive Radio Network. Ooh.